Okay,
this meeting is being recorded.
To begin with a few words about Parshas Naso. Parshas Naso is the longest Parsha in the Torah. It's that magic number of 176, which is apparently the number for all the longest things within Torah. It's the number of blocks in the longest Masechta in Bava Basra. It's the number of Sukkim in the longest Parak in Tanakh in Tehillim. And it's the number of Sukkim and the longest Parsha in the Torah. So there's a lot to talk about in Parshas Naso, but we won't be talking about all of it at all. And our approach has been to deal with one Aliyah a year per week. So we're still in the year we're talking about Rishon. Rishon is not the jam-packed content that you find in the rest of the Parsha. But that's a part of the advantage to give us the opportunity to look at Psukim that we wouldn't otherwise see, wouldn't otherwise get so much attention. So we'll do a little bit of that, and then maybe say a little bit about some of the themes in the rest of the Parsha, or one or two of the themes. So first, about the Parsha as a whole. So there is a tradition, the way we have Kriyas HaTorah set up nowadays, and the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch talk about this, that Bamidbar is traditionally assigned to before Shavuos and also after Shavuos, like we find now. And there are various suggestions as to why things are set up that way. What is the symbolism? This year it happens to take us off course with Eretz Yisrael because of the structure of Yantif. They had Parshas Naso last week. We're only getting to it this week because of the two-day Yantif that we had and they didn't have. But one way or another, it comes after Shavuos for both settings. And the message is subject to a number of interpretations. So among the suggestions, I believe in the Sefer Paris Yosef HaChadosh, quotes from the Sifsei Tzadik, that it has to do with the fact that in the Parsha we also find themes of vidui. We find the whole notion of the tshuva process through its vehicle of vidui. And it reflects the idea that Shavuos, even though it's not listed as one of the Rosh Hashanahs, but Shavuos is a time when looking towards a new phase, that we're not the same people after having received the Torah as we were before receiving the Torah. And it represents something new as far as our mindset and as far as our attitudes, essentially a new year in its own sense. And therefore, perhaps it's meant to prompt a theme of tshuva, that as we become people who are more educated and with more spiritual potential, and we are encountering a new directive, so we have to become people who rise to the occasion. We have to reevaluate. We have to look and see how indeed can we be people who rise up to that occasion, and therefore new responsibilities bring a new level of expectation. And the theme of vidui that exists in this parsha is one of those ideas. And that, of course, is an important concept, that we recognize that the Torah is a source of a mandate and responsibility for us, and that a part of recognizing that we've reached a higher level means appreciating where there's a need for a new evaluation of what we're capable of and what we can improve from the past. In a similar sense, but perhaps with a different focus, the Kadjuk Lavarav. The Kadjuk Lavarav was one of the great students of the Sachachav Rebbe, of the Avnei Nezer. And he is known for his tshuvos. He also has drashos, and in his drashos he suggests that the idea of having Nasa at this point maybe doesn't only focus on vidui, but focuses on bracha. That one of the other mitzvot that we have in the Parsha is Birchas Kohanim, is the idea that the Kohanim have to bless the people, and this is a source of bracha that is profound and distinct. And we have a notion also consistent with looking at this as kind of a new year, and it's maybe easier for us to relate to that because it's a new Zman in a lot of ways, but we do have a sense of Hizchadshus here. So the idea of a new year brings with it the notion that Chazal have of Tichla Shana V'Kilosa V'Kachol Shana V'Birchosa, that we want to put all of the less pleasant aspects of the previous year behind us, and we want to start a new year with bracha. And therefore, we have Birchas Kohanim as a theme to open up a new phase. And before that, we had Bechukosai, which has so many more negative concepts, to say the least, that we want to assign to the previous year. We spoke about this a little bit, Parshas Bamidbar, that it's interesting if that's the focus that Bechukosai should be for the last year, but still there is something that has to happen in between, because we have Bamidbar between Bechukosai and Shavuot, and there are some who suggest that that reflects the theme of the unity of the Jewish people, that in Bamidbar we read about counting all the people, but also their names and their identities being factored in as a crucial element. So the unity of the Jewish people with its diversity is a necessary step to get us packed, get us past the klolos of Bechukosai. And then we get now to the brachos of Parshas Naso. That should be our theme for an upcoming year. And of course, it's been a very complicated tkufa for all of us in so many ways. So certainly the notion that this is a time of renewal and a time where we're looking forward to greater opportunities and to a different environment is one that we can relate to in a very powerful way. But just to look a little bit, we won't even do too much of this, but just to look a little bit at what is in the first Aliyah. So the first Aliyah really continues themes from the end of Bamidbar, talking about the missions and about the functions of the children of Levi. Children of Levi, you know, were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Gershon was the Bechor. But here we find he doesn't get first billing. So he's coming after the other brothers that were in the end of Parshas Bamidbar. And here in the beginning of Naso, so it picks up from that, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'emor, Naso es rosh b'nei Gershon gam hei. Also, lift up the heads of B'nai Gershon, of the family of Gershon, L'vei Sabosam, L'mishpachosam. So here it's also interesting that the concept of being a part of their family, L'mishpachosam, in Parshas Bamidbar, it's reversed. It's L'mishpachosam, L'vei Sabosam, comes first, and here it's switched around, and that's itself an interesting point to try to see why that should be. But there is a medrash here that also has an interesting comment in comparing the two. That here, Gershon is the Bechor, but he's coming after Kohath, and Kohath is in the previous Parsha, where he carries the Aron, and that represents the Torah. And so the Medrash comments over here, actually, that Yakari Himipninim, that the Torah is more precious than pearls, is more precious than diamonds and precious stones, and therefore that it comes previous, it comes in the last parsha, even though Gershon is the Bechor. And it's an interesting question why exactly that should be, and why exactly Gershon is placed in the middle, so to speak, because even if you want to say, okay, so the Torah comes first, but then why is it set up that way? And there is also perhaps another angle, the Chassam Sofer has a comment over here that sometimes that which comes in the middle is actually the most chashuv position. And you see this in the Gemara Menachos, talks about the menorah and the Beis HaMikdash, that all the flames were focused towards the middle, that the middle was the most distinguished position. And the Maharal in the Gur Aryeh has a comment about the concept of middle in general, that sometimes that which is in the middle is the most chashuv because it's a way of reflecting everything that's on the outside. It's a way of incorporating all of the various elements. And that, of course, brings to mind this week we mourned the loss of Rabbi Dr. Lamb, Zichrono Livracha, who had such an influence on so many of us and on our yeshiva as a whole. And it was well known that he didn't like the term modern Orthodox. He didn't feel that was the appropriate name, and that he referred instead to centrist Orthodox, of which there's much to expound upon what that means. but lends itself also to the connotation of that which includes everything, that which brings everything towards the center, which brings everything towards the middle. And we know that Rabbi Lam espoused a theology and a philosophy that brought everything together in the service of Torah and in the service of Avodas Hashem. And it's significant to take note of that and reflect on the interesting parallel that perhaps we see there a little bit. It's also interesting that we have an idea, the Parashat Sefer Charash, which is a beautiful collection of a lot of ideas in the Parsha, makes note that there is an idea that the Aron actually carried itself, and that you didn't need to work so hard in order to carry the Aron, which is interesting because it seems to be in tension with another idea that we find the Ramban in his commentary to Chumash points out that you could only have people who are 30 who would carry the Aron because they had to carry it on their shoulder. They had to be strong. So which is it? So is it carrying itself or does it need human strength in order to carry? And Rabbi Moshe Feinstein has a comment about this in his Sefer Darash Moshe, where he notes that this is the way Torah is bechlal, that really Torah is a gift to us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is providing us both with the content and the ability to appreciate it and to learn it and to hold on to it. And yet, we still need to put in our effort. Even though it's there as a matana, even though it's there, so to speak, miraculously, we still have to put in our own efforts in order to merit that. And that's also one of the themes of Shavuos, that we have this tension, this perhaps balance between the notion that Torah is a matana, and at the same time, it's also a lekach. Kilekach tov nasati lachem tarosti al tazovu. This was a theme, one of the great students of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, who's Rabbi Yitzchak Blazer, Rabbi Yitzchak Petterberger, and he wrote a tshuva, it's called the Pri Yitzchak. So in the introduction to the Pri Yitzchak, he talks about this, about how Torah is both a gift to us, as also something we have to acquire, we have to earn, and we do so through our efforts, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu meets us in that process, and that's certainly also a theme of Shavuos, and of course something very much reflective of what we try to take away from that Yadif, recognizing that that's very much a part of the message as well. So it's also important to note that Kahas, who do have an advantage here. They carry the Torah. So Kahas gets highlighted in the previous parsha. And there is some discussion in the commentaries, if Gershon was the Bechor, so then why does Kahas have this higher stature? And some suggest it's going forward instead of going backward, that Gershon has the yichus of having been born first. That's something. But Kahas has the yichus of his descendants, because who came from Kahas? Moshe and Aaron. So certainly there is a successful transmission of a value system that is there. And this Midah, some suggest, is reflected the idea of Kahas. You know, we know we say in the Haggadah, Afat HaKeyeshinov, that means blunted teeth. And the commentaries find that there is a symbolism there, that teeth are visible externally, and that it's a reflection of the ability to sympathize with the suffering of others. It seems a little hard to see how that's in the words, but that's how commentaries have understood it. There's a discussion about this through Batal Radinsky of Muncie, and the Sefer Mishkan Batal has a discussion of how the symbolism can be found there. And we know that this is the midah of Moshe Rabbeinu, that Moshe Rabbeinu was able to feel the suffering of the people, even though he wasn't necessarily experiencing himself. He was in a very different environment as a child and as he was growing up. But nonetheless, that's something that he was able to incorporate, that he was able to recognize, that he can have that sense of achrayus for other people. And that midah is crucial, and that midah is really what Torah is about, to be able to empathize and to be able to recognize the suffering of others. And this is something which is always necessary in order to be able to accept the Torah. And it's something very much on our minds this week in America, as we see there's terrible anguish going on at the ongoing impact of racism and discrimination and prejudice and dehumanization. And that's something that always has to concern us and that we always have to have as a part of our consciousness a sympathy and an empathy for that feeling of discrimination and of racial mistreatment, and recognizing that quod ad rios, that human dignity, is one of our fundamental principles. And this is something which also is relevant in our parsha, later in the parsha beyond Rishon. So we read about the concept of Nazir. And the Nazir, like a Kohen Gadol, the Nazir is somebody who is not allowed to be metame, is not allowed to come into contact with a dead body, and more so than even a Kohen, because a Kohen has the exception for his relatives, a Nazir, like a Kohen Gadol, doesn't have an exception. But Chazal points out there is an exception, there is one exception. They're not allowed to be metame to their family members, the Kohen Gadol and the Nazir, but there is an exception. There is a situation where they are obligated to be metame, and that is a meis mitzvah. That if there's somebody who no one else is going to attend to the needs of the kvura, so then even the Kohen Gadol has to get involved, and even a nazir has to get involved, and that reflects the principle of quod habrios, of human dignity, which mandates that the proper respect be given to somebody who passed away. And the notion of Kavod HaMeis, as Rav Schechter always emphasizes, is not a new concept. It's not that Kavod all of a sudden develops once a person passes away, that when somebody's alive, then you can treat them however you want, it doesn't matter. But after they die, all of a sudden, Kavod HaMeis, we have to be careful, we have to treat them properly. It's the other way around, that there is a mandate of Kavod HaBrios, of human dignity, that is crucial all the time to everyone. Adam is Nivra Ebetzalem, the human beings are all created in the image of God, and therefore, as a function of that, all humanity is due respect through this basic Kavod HaBrios principle. And Rav Soloveitchik emphasized in one of his drashos that you see just how significant it is, because if you look at the example of the Kohen Gadol, the same halacha as Nazir, so the Kohen Gadol here is the set aside as the holiest person, the most dedicated person within the Jewish population, and he does the avoda on Yom Kippur of Snaivlistin. He goes to the place that no one else goes to on the holiest day of the year, so the holiest Jew at the holiest moment in the holiest place. All of that would be set aside for the needs of any individual who is not being attended to in terms of their dignity. That Kavod HaBrios is such an overwhelming principle that it is prioritized even over that moment of very specific Kedusha for that very specific individual. And the priority of Kavod HaBrios is such that the Gemara tells us in a number of places, five places throughout Shas, that Kavod HaBrios is a huge mandate. The language of the Gemara is Gadol Kavod HaBrios. Kavod HaBrios is a very powerful principle that it's able to override many areas in halacha. And that's an interesting discussion. It's a whole sugya where it does and where it doesn't, but there clearly are many places in halacha where Kavod HaBrios does take a huge priority. And it's a fascinating idea because we said that man is created in the image of God, so we understand that by prioritizing the dignity of the individual, so you are showing honor to God, you are showing how much you respect God through his creations, but that doesn't explain why we would prioritize that over other areas of halacha. So if you have a mitzvah to do, so then, okay, you're honoring God through the mitzvah, so why would you set that mitzvah aside to honor his creations? You would think that cut out the middleman, go directly to God. Now there is a striking medrash in Parshas Balak, a few weeks ahead, that in Parshas Balak the medrash says that even though you would have thought that the talking donkey from Bilam would have been a great exhibit in the Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum of Miracles, nonetheless, So it wasn't kept around to represent God's great care for the Jewish people, as much as it would have been impressive, because it was a bizoyon to Bilam. It was a disgrace to Bilam. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu made sure that Bilam wouldn't be subject to that bizoyon, and you see how much he worries about the Kavod Avrios, even of somebody like Bilam, so Kal Vachomer for everybody else. And that reflects that same kind of surprise that within Halacha to say that we should prioritize Kvod Havrios over honoring God directly sometimes. The Gemara says not prioritized over Achil Hashem, because we have the Pasuk Ein Eitzah, Ein Chochma, Ein Tvuna L'Neged Hashem, that we don't give attention to anything else in a place where there's Achil Hashem. But we do apparently pass up opportunities that we would prioritize being mechabed, the individual, over sometimes even some halachic mandates that would have prioritized God directly. And it's a fascinating kind of trade-off. I think you could explain the idea by noting that the concept of kavod has unique attributes to it. And there is a tension there, which maybe you could call the paradox of the Baal Gaiva. That the Baal Gaiva, the Baal Musar talked about this, that you have somebody who's very self-focused and who's very haughty, so he doesn't really care about anybody else. He's not going to be machshiv. He's not going to give attention to anyone else because all he cares about is himself. But he'll pretend, so to speak, he'll act as if the other person is worthwhile, in order to be able to take a compliment from them, in order to be able to take their respect. Because if you think about it, it doesn't make sense. If you don't have any respect for anyone else, you don't have any regard for anyone else, then their compliments aren't significant. So to take their respect, you have to shift your mentality to something that's not really how you think normally. So that's what the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos seems to be getting at. When the Mishnah says, Ezehu mechubad ha-mechabed es avrios, that who is it who is honorable, one who honors others. So it sounds like it's quid pro quo. So I'll honor you, you honor me. But it seems like it's more fundamental, that essentially what it's saying is that the only way one can get kavod, the only way one can be honored, is if he first acknowledges the kavod of others, if he first recognizes that others are honorable, so then there's a foundation where you can be honored back. But if you don't acknowledge first the honor of others, so then there isn't anywhere for that honor to come from. What's the significance of being respected by people you don't respect? So therefore, it's in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's interest, so to speak, that humanity be respectable and be honored, and that human dignity be respected, because it's through that that there is a source of kavod, a source of honor, that can ultimately go back to the Ribono Shel Olam. So the notion of the dignity of every individual being upheld and being revered is crucial in order to provide that foundation for there to be kvod shamayim in the first place. So we have to be very sensitive and very aware of this notion of kvod havrios and of basic human dignity in the way everybody is treated. And that's true from one end of the spectrum to the other. It's true from the way that we talk and the way we relate and interact and the way we talk to people and the way we talk about people. It has to reflect this basic core of human dignity. And we see the other end of the spectrum, that when there isn't that mindset and that attitude and that hisyapsis, that kind of relationship, so sometimes it can even relate, it can even result, God forbid, in people being killed because of dehumanization and a lack of basic regard for their individual dignity. So this is a crucial value that we reaffirm all the more powerfully in light of the events of these past days and these past weeks, the need to recognize the kavod habrios of every individual and to make sure that that is something that is reflected in our behavior and in our speech and in all of our actions. And it's also important to emphasize that, you know, there are those who will say that when we express identification, we should express identification because of our own history of persecution. And of course, that's true, but one might think, okay, but even without that, like Moshe Rabbeinu, we should be able to have an identification of the suffering, even if we weren't necessarily a part of the suffering. But it's also true that that ability to tap into our own history is something that the Torah emphasizes again and again. And the Torah tells us constantly that we should have sympathy for those who are disadvantaged or for those who feel alienated and separated because we ourselves went through that history in Mitzrayim. And we just observed Shavuot and the Kriyas HaTorah for the last day of Shavuot, last day of every Yartif. It's from Parshas Re'eh, and it goes through all of the Yom Tovim. And it's striking that in the context of Shavuot, so the Torah also makes reference, says, Zacharto ki Eved Hayisa b'Mitzrayim, that you should remember that you were an Eved in Mitzrayim. And it's a little bit surprising in that context because we know that Pesach is about our history of being Avadim and Mitzrayim. And we know that Sukkot is also about the history of Yetzias Mitzrayim. But why does Shavuot have this theme of remember that used to be Avadim and Mitzrayim? And Torah Tamima has one approach, and my grandfather, Shlomo Baruch, wrote a commentary on Torah Tamima where he observed that he doesn't like the Torah Tamima's approach, and he notes that the theme, the Torah reminding us that we were Avadim in the context of Shavuot is because when we have Simchas Yontif, when we celebrate Yontif for any event, so we have to recognize, as Rambam emphasizes in Hilchos Yontif, that we have to be aware of the needs of others, and that that awareness, which has to manifest itself and express itself in that context, is one that is crucial to any kind of genuine simcha. We can't have any simchas yontif if it's not combined with that awareness of the needs of others, which does connect to our own history, which does draw upon this awareness of our past as avadim. That's something that does make a difference in our ability to effectively do so. And therefore, even if we'd say, okay, we'd like to be like Moshe Rabbeinu and be able to empathize, even if it's not a part of our experience, now, there is a tradition of Innocent Eifshus that comments that the reason that Levi, the tribe of Levi, was excluded from the Shivud was because Paro was told by his fortune tellers that there was going to be a redeemer of the Jewish people who was going to come from Shevet Levi. So Paro thought that, okay, if I take Levi out of the Shivud, if I don't enslave them, so then they're not going to care. So this redeemer is not going to ever rise up to that mission because he's not going to be a part of their experience. And clearly he underestimated Moshe Rabbeinu, who was doubly removed from that experience and yet was able to feel that sympathy and that connectedness to the suffering of his people and become our greatest leader. So certainly we would see that as a madriga to aspire to, but the Torah is acknowledging that to be able to tap into our history is something that plays a tremendous role in terms of how we are able to connect the experience of others. And that's something that is useful and that's something that contributes in a significant way. And that's also a theme in the parsha. We talk about Birchas Kohanim. So there are some who ask that if we put so much emphasis on Torah, and we just came off Shavuos and we said that Torah is such an ideal, and in fact, the Gemara tells us at the end of Maseches Horeis, and some of the Midrashim say on these Pesukim as well, in the first three shown, first Aliyah in Nasa, that the Karihim of Ninim, like we mentioned before, Torah is so great, so Torah transcends that a Talmud Chacham has a greater status than a Kohen. So, that being the case, so if we're looking for a bracha, so why do we turn to the Kohanim for a bracha? Why don't we turn to Talmidei Chachamim for a bracha? What is it about Kohanim that is special and that provides us with bracha in a way that is distinct? And there are some who suggest the Sefer called Eshkol Yosef has many approaches to that question. And one of the points he mentions, if I remember correctly, is that the Kohanim are dependent on support from the people. If the Kohanim live off the Truma, so they get supported by the people. So to whatever extent the people are successful, so too the Kohanim are more successful, so or successful in proportion to how the people are successful. So therefore the Kohanim are invested in the well-being of the populace, and that is crucial for this bracha to be heartfelt. So the ability to be able to connect, to find something within yourself that pushes the bracha and that pushes the emotion behind it is something that is very useful, and that's something that can be tapped into. It's a great purpose, and that's also a part of the message here. So we very much want to try to find within ourselves the ability to connect to the suffering of those around us, and to recognize that that is emphasized by the Torah again and again as a necessary part of our personality and a part of the experience of coming out of Avdus and reaching a new stage of responsibility that the Torah mandates for us. And part of that message of the Torah giving us a new lease on life is that we have a higher standard of expectation, and that should be something that we feel very powerfully, and that should inform everything that we do. So just to segue back now into Gneivas Das, so that higher standard of responsibility also requires a higher standard of honesty and integrity. And so we laid out over the past few days some of the details in the sugya and the Gemara and Chulin of what Gneivas Das is about and what it requests of us. So we'll spend a few more minutes today, and then probably also pick up on Monday, talking about some of the practical ramifications. And so what do we know so far? We know that we're not permitted to be machzik tov b'chinom, in Rashi's words, that we're not allowed to try to capitalize on unjustified good feeling, that if we create the impression that we're doing things that we're not necessarily doing, so then that gives us unfair and unearned regard from others, and that's something that we're not allowed to do. And we discussed that this could come from a number of places. It could be a representation of some type of gneva, prompting the question of, is it that the goodwill itself is tangible, or is it that it may lead to some kind of actual reciprocity, and that's what we're concerned about? Or is it simply an aspect of honesty and avoidance of sheker, that we can't be dishonest in our speech, whether it's overt dishonesty, whether it's complete falsehood, or whether it's creating a false impression, even in a less direct way, that's also something that is a betrayal of our character. So all of that could be true, and we noted that the Rambam at least has both presentations in two places, in Hilchos Mechira and in Hilchos Deis, and that they all seem to influence our behavior, even if possibly to different degrees. So what practical manifestations does this have for us? So first of all, to focus on the Mechira component. So we see that a part of what's going on in the context of Mechira is that even if what you're offering is a valid price, and even if you're not cheating anybody out of money, so just to, we've been using the example from the Gemara, that the Gemara has a case, if you're selling sandals, and sandals, the assumption is that a sandal is of higher quality if it comes from an animal that was healthy and shechted, a leather sandal, the leather is of higher quality from a healthy animal than from an animal that died on its own. So you're not allowed to represent the sandal as coming from the healthy animal as opposed to the lower quality sandal that would come from an animal that died on its own. And what the commentaries emphasize is if I would charge the higher price, so then that would be, oh no, that would be fraud. I'd be taking money I don't deserve. But if I charge the lower price, but I represent it as a bigger deal, so that's still a problem. That's the problem of Gneivas Das. So to zero in on the nature of that problem, so one issue in the context of Mechira, and we talked yesterday about the fact that some of the Rishonim see the issue as specifically in the context of a transaction, of a Mechira, more so than in the context of a Matana, that in a gift you wouldn't necessarily have the same consideration, but as a Matana, but as a Mechir you would. So part of the idea seems to be that there's something dishonest happening if the purchaser is pulled into the deal under false pretenses. That even if he's getting a fair price, but if he was given the impression that this is something that's a unique opportunity, or that there is something that is different here from what would have been otherwise. So that itself is a violation of the integrity necessary in the business deal. So anything that gets the person in the door under false pretenses is a halachic problem. So, for example, one of the very problematic strategies that you sometimes find in business, it's probably crediting it too much to call it even a business strategy because it's really something very problematic, is what's known as the bait and switch, that you advertise something and you don't really have that product. Or maybe you have that product, but so few of them that it's not realistic that the people you're advertising to are going to get it by the time they come to the store. So you're advertising this item because you want people to come to the store. And then when they come to the store, so, oh, sorry, we're out of that, but maybe you want this. You missed that opportunity, but we have this instead. So it's a bait and switch. You brought them in with the bait. You said, come for the special deal. And then when they come, you switch it. That's not what you have. So that's problematic on many levels. It's a problem of Onoa also, of Onoa's Devarim, because here, creating that disappointment that people think they're going to get this great deal and it never really existed for them. But also that's Kenevas Das in the sense that you brought them into the transaction under false pretenses. There, at least they'll find out before they spend any money. But then already your plan here, such as it is okay, but now you're ready in the store, so maybe you want this, maybe you want that. So bringing them in under these pretenses is problematic. One of the great poskim in Eretz Yisrael, Moshe Mordechai Karp, wrote an article where he has a criticism against a practice which is done really by every business all the time, anywhere, since we were all born. So it's hard to find so much objection to this because it's clearly the widespread minig of the whole world. So that's a counterpoint, but it's interesting just to reflect upon. That he has an objection from the perspective of Gnevis Das to 99 pricing. You know, that you don't sell for $10, you sell for $9.99. It's not $100, it's $99.99. So what's the point? Clearly the math would be easier if you just said $10 or you just said $100. So what's the point in pricing things that way? So the point seems to be that you create this mental impression, oh, it's not even $10, it's less than $10, it's less than $100. But clearly it's not less, especially once you add on the tax and once you add on whatever other fees, it's going to be literally more. But even if it really was $9.99, so $9.99 is not functionally different than $10, and $99.99 is not functionally different than $100. So what are you accomplishing by calling it $99.99? You're accomplishing that the person thinks a little bit, oh, no, that's a great deal, it's less than $100. But functionally, it's not less than $100 at all. As Rav Karp points out, this is a particularly problematic point if you're an Eretz Yisrael, because if they charge $99.99, so there's no one agura coin. So it's literally 100 shekels. There is no difference in any sense of the word between $99.99 and 100, unless you're buying in bulk, then it multiplies. But if you're buying one item, there's no way to translate that into anything real. So all it does is it creates this impression that it's less than what it really is as far as the cost, or it's more than what it really is as far as the value. And that's something which is hard to be that critical about, because again, it's something every store we've ever been in and every website and anywhere we've ever seen uses this. So I don't know if any of us are fooled by that, but it's interesting to reflect on what its origins are and what exactly it's meant to do to us psychologically, and it's an interesting observation. And it's also worth noting that if a store carries out sales all the time that aren't really sales, if it has legitimate sales, so then that's a thing. But to represent something as being on sale, special price, only now, so that's a part of what we're talking about, that creates the mentality that this is something special, that this is something that you're not going to have an opportunity for later, and you should jump on it now because of that, and that's problematic. It's interesting, there is a Richard Thaler, who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago, probably two, 3 years ago, he won the Nobel Prize for Economics, and he was one of the founders of the field of behavioral economics. If you're familiar with the writings of Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who became very well known, Kahneman especially in past years, wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, talks about different ways in which we relate to decisions. And behavioral economics is a field which brings together the elements of economic theory and understanding of human nature based on the premise that economists are often wrong because they assume everyone is purely rational and that everyone always acts to maximize gain and minimize losses. And you can predict patterns based on that, but then it turns out to be wrong because people aren't really purely rational, which is not even to say they're necessarily irrational, but that they have considerations that are not just about maximizing gain and minimizing loss. They have psychological elements also. They have aspects of human nature that also affect how they make decisions. So behavioral economics brought these fields together in order to factor in those considerations. So Richard Thaler wrote his memoir a few years ago, a book called Misbehaving, where he talks there about one of the major retailers in the United States sent out a communication to all of its customers, to the whole world, and basically said that we recognize that it's not fully respectful of the intelligence of our customers and of our commitment to integrity that we say everything's on sale, this is happening, special opportunity, and we create the impression that things are happening that aren't really happening, or that there is an opportunity here that is somehow different than all the other times of the year. So from here on in, we're going to be straight with you, and we have the best prices all year round, and it's not a special sale, and we're not going to create that impression, and we're just going to deal with you in a completely forthright manner. So that was their policy, and what happened? So what was the result? So their stock went way down. Apparently, they didn't get the business they were hoping for, and things went in the opposite direction. So Thaler points out there that apparently what was discovered from things like this is that when people purchase something, so they need two types of benefit. They need the utility that comes from the item, but they also need transactional utility. And they need to feel that they're getting a good deal with the transaction itself. They have to get some value out of that, not just the item they're purchasing, but, oh, there's a special deal that also attracts them. So I don't know what to do with that as a matter of halacha, that here we're saying that Gnei Das is telling you not to act that way, and here he's suggesting that customers want to be treated that way, that they want to feel that there is a special value not only to the item they're getting, but to how they're getting it. So I don't know what to do with that, practically speaking. It's just telling us maybe that we have to nonetheless prioritize our integrity even over that and let the chips fall where they may. But it's a very interesting point as far as how it relates to this issue. This is exactly what we're concerned about, that essentially that's a manipulation of the psychology of the customer. And as much as that may be effective, maybe that's Thaler's point, that still this is what people want. They need to be, they feel like they need to be treated this way. Still, we have to recognize that it's manipulative, and that's in the spirit of what the Rambam writes, calling it pitoy, a type of seduction, essentially, that you're saying the right words to win someone over, but it doesn't necessarily make it honest or an expression of integrity. And that's something that we also have to be concerned about. In general, so we find this to be an issue. The poskim talk about that if you're going to present your item in a way that is deceptive somehow. So let's say you're going to sell your house, so you're going to paint it to look like it's a newer house than it is. Or when they would sell meat, so they would put some water in it to make it look fresher. And there's a problem of Gnevas Das. So here, in light of what we've been talking about, it's important to appreciate that this whole question of presentation, so there are three levels, and each one has a different impact to Lahalacha, that on the one hand, let's say you're going to try to make something look newer than it is or fresher than it is, and you're going to sell at that price. You're going to say, okay, this house is newer, and therefore I'm selling it at the higher price to reflect that it's a younger house, or this meat is fresher, I'm selling it at the higher price. So that is, again, oh no, that's fraud, and that's the bigger problem. Then you're taking money under unjust circumstances. That's like selling these $8 sandals for $10. So that's a different problem beyond Geneva stock. What Knevis Das is that you are going to sell it for the appropriate price, but you're going to create the expectation that it's a special deal based on this treatment. So you're going to say, okay, look here, this is a new house, and you're getting it for the price of an old house. This is fresh meat, and you're getting it for the price of meat that's less fresh. So that is Knevis Das, and maybe not just because they'll be grateful to you, but because you're going to motivate people to jump on the deal, to think, okay, this is a special opportunity and I should buy it now when I can. And that luring them in is Geneva's Das, even though it doesn't translate to any monetary difference. So that's the second level. The third level is something else, which is that you are presenting things in a way that's not fundamentally different, but it's simply the best within its range. So when a person is selling something, a person will sell a house, so we understand that you're going to present it in the best possible way out of the ways it could be presented. And that's not a dishonesty issue. That we understand that, okay, you're going to spruce it up, and you're going to maybe paint it so that it looks the best that it can look right now, but that's different than trying to make it look as something other than it is. That's called putting your best foot forward, and that people expect. So when you go on a job interview, so we understand that you're going to dress up in a way that's maybe more than you normally would on an average day. When you go on a date, so you're also going to dress up in a way that doesn't necessarily represent your average day, but that's not necessarily deceptive, depending, of course, on how you do it. But that's called putting your best foot forward, that people understand that if there's a range of 1 to 10 in how you can present yourself, so in these contexts, you're going to present yourself in the maximal way. That's different than trying to misrepresent what you are or what it is that you're selling. And that people expect, and that people calibrate. And in fact, they'd be offended if you didn't do that. If you show up on a first date, if you show up on a interview, and you don't create the impression that you're trying to put your best foot forward, you're trying to express and convey yourself in the best possible way, so then you're going to offend the party that you're dealing with. So that's a third category. So it's important to appreciate that there are three different categories here in terms of the presentation. If you present yourself in a false way and extract the price for that, then that's the worst. That's ona. If you present yourself in a false way and you don't extract any more value, but you create the impression that, oh, jump at this because this is a special opportunity, so that's Geneva's Das. And if you present yourself in the best possible way out of all the ways that you can, but it's not fundamentally a misrepresentation, so then that's presumably not a problem at all. And in fact, sometimes that's expected, and that's a different category. So to try to separate between the three is important. Each one has a different attitude as far as what the halacha would require. Everything makes sense so far? Everybody following? I should also mention that one, we're just, I guess now everyone's at a different phase in terms of the previous semester and the June's month and the June summer session. So I know I'm holding in tests and turning in grades and the like, and finals has a big hold on all of us, whether you're a teacher or a student. I think students are also distracted a little bit by finals sometimes, parents, not just teachers. And the question of academic integrity is a very big one, and it's one that has to always be emphasized, just exactly what role it plays. And we should appreciate that cheating on tests is not only against university policy, which, by the way, it is very much so. But it's also against halacha for many reasons. But at a very basic level, it's always going to be at least Gnevis Das. It may be other things as well. But at a minimum, it's Gnevis Das, because the purpose of cheating on a test is at least to convince at least one other person that something is there that isn't there, either that you're more prepared or that you're more aware of material or that you're more advanced, even if it's only one person is going to see it. So that's your goal, otherwise it wouldn't be cheating in the first place. So at a minimum, it's Gnevis Das, and that's always going to be the case. So certainly cheating on any test has that component to it and should be prohibited for that reason. And it's also important to note that its impact, especially at the college level and above, its impact could ripple in many different ways, and it could easily transition from Gnevis Das to Gnevis Mammon, that especially because grades have an impact, especially at this stage, your GPA and your resume and class standing and future employment could all be affected by a false effort, such as it is, towards grades. And that's something that could impact others in very real ways. So if you end up in a different ranking as far as class standing, if you end up getting a job or an award that you wouldn't otherwise get, so that is coming at somebody else's expense, and that is not just Gnevis Das, it's probably Gnevis Mammon also, and that's something that reflects itself also in the academic policies. So not only is it prohibited to cheat by university policy, something good to be aware of, but you're also, if you check the university policy, you're also obligated to turn in somebody else who does cheat, which is much harder to ask somebody to do. That's definitely something people struggle with more, but it's based in this concept, among other things, that somebody who's cheating is hurting other people, is essentially stealing from classmates, stealing from future employers. So there is the aspect of lo samar al dam reyecha, that you have to protect others who are at risk of being victimized and step in to stop that from happening. So that reflects the fact that there is an impact on others also. It's not just that you are being dishonest in your representation, but it has an effect on other people. Ari?
From the perspective of the teacher, could curving a test such that, you know, if the highest score was 28 out of 30, they make the entire test out of 30, could that be a form of Gnevis Das, because then it makes these students seem better percentage-wise than other students who their test wasn't curved in a different part of the country and who actually got 28 out of 30.
Okay, so here I'll ask for a little Rachmanis for teachers to say that part of the challenge, a curve in general is introduced theoretically in order to make things more accurate, but it could be misused. It's a very delicate tool. That the purpose of a curve, when it's used, I think, in general, is if there is a feeling that the grade itself wouldn't represent things fully accurately, and maybe, for example, if a curve is brought in afterwards because there's a surprise in how the grades turned out, so the feeling that they need to be recalibrated. So theoretically, it comes from a place of seeking greater accuracy, at least most of the time. But it could go in both directions. So what you're referring to worst is probably not necessarily the curve per se, but what's called a grade inflation, that the idea that the grades are pumped up, and that creates a skewed impact. So that is a concern, but there's a lot of factors that go into trying to figure out what is the most justified and fairest grade, and I'll tell you from the teacher's perspective, it's something that we struggle with tremendously. And we try very, very hard to give something that is fair from both directions, to give a grade that does fairly validate and recognize the work that the students do, and also does not put them at an unfair advantage vis-a-vis others when their grades are coming from other teachers and other institutions and for other purposes. And halavai, there really was one unified standard across the world that meant everyone would be treated equally. So it's very hard to fully live up to all those challenges at the same time. So we do the best we can to try to make it as fair as possible, both to the students and to everyone else who the student is interacting with. I can tell you it's an enormous amount of work, and coming off of 2 weeks of that right now with a tremendous intensity of effort and focus, it's something which is very, very draining. It's something which takes a lot of commitment to try to do as fairly as possible from all sides. But here's the answer to your question, essentially, is that yes, there is a theoretical problem there, but in practice it's very complex, and it's something that the teachers struggle with greatly in order to try to do as fairly as possible and avoid all those traps to whatever extent they can. But it's very challenging. So finals, I guess, are a little hard for students also, but they're definitely hard for teachers. So, but this idea, Rav Moshe Feinstein already pointed out many years ago in a tshuva, that this is taking tests in any subject, in Torah, in secular studies, taking the regents, he talked about in his tshuva, that relate to them in any kind of a dishonest manner is an avera for many reasons, has many kinds of halachic objections, but at a minimal level, it's always going to be Gnevus Das, that you're always trying to convince somebody of something that's not really there for whatever benefit, major or minor, that is going to come. And therefore, that by itself is enough of a reason to very strongly prohibit such activity. So that's another halachic ramification. There are more ramifications, but I represented to you that we would finish at the 12th. I don't want to do any false representations. But I assume so probably be one more day. Like Monday, we'll talk about a few other practical halachic applications, really focus more on them, the practicality. There are a few more to talk about. And then I can foretell the future that we'll try to talk about Nechush a little bit and about fortune telling. That is daf immediately afterwards. Any other questions? Everything clear? Everything makes sense? Okay, so I wish everyone a Shabbos of safety, of health, of mutual respect, of kindness, and of growth. And I look forward to seeing you next week. And again, any of you who haven't spoken to one-on-one, you're very encouraged to reach out. And it should be only good things. I should have an uplifting Shabbos Nasa. Thank you.